Welcome to Riff Ram Review, your TCU sports talk home right here on 88.7 KTCU The Choice. Here are your hosts, Luke Anderson, Jackson James, and Ian Napier. And welcome back to Riff Ram Review right here on 88.7 The Choice, your choice for college radio. Ian Napier here, joined alongside by Jackson James and Luke Anderson as we get set for another episode of Riff Ram Review. Gentlemen, welcome in. How are you boys doing?
I'm doing dandy. I had a great weekend of sports, not only just in baseball, but in basketball as well. And more basketball as the NBA season is coming to a close. And we have the final college basketball game of the season on tonight. So it's sad, but it's also, I'm hoping for another legendary game this weekend, yeah. Or I guess this week.
Oh, yeah, watching a lot of sports this weekend. It was awesome getting to catch the second weekend of MLB. You know, TCU had a couple baseball games on Thursday and then a baseball game on Friday. And then we got to watch, of course, as you mentioned, the women's Final Four and national championship and the men's Final Four. And then we got the national championship tonight that I'm super excited for. So just been a sports-packed weekend, and you know we're continuing that on and into some nicer weather here.
Yeah, seriously, talking about weather, my goodness. I mean, I'm thrilled that it's actually sunny. It's 65 and a little chillier than I'm used to, but when you're in the sun, it's actually kind of nice. But this weekend, holy cow, Thursday through at least Sunday was like mid-40s yesterday at least. I was not ready for that.
Overcast all day, yeah.
Yeah, so once again, still getting used to this weather here in Texas after 3.5 years here, but we've got a fantastic episode on tap for everybody tonight. We're going to start it off with baseball, then go into some women's March Madness, kind of recap the tournament because we didn't get a chance to talk about it last Monday with TCU playing Texas in the Elite Eight. But we're going to recap the women's tournament, quickly look into the transfer portal for TCU, and then also talk about some of ESPN's way too early top 25, which does not include the TCU Horned Frogs. Then we'll move over to men's hoops, talk about TCU basketball, some transfer portal movement there as well, recap some March Madness happenings as well before jumping into some MLB talk and some NBA talk to round out the rest of tonight's show. So starting off with TCU baseball, gentlemen, it was a great weekend. Not your typical or standard weekend at that, with BYU coming into town. So TCU playing a doubleheader on Thursday, then the third game of the series on Friday. Weather was definitely going to be a problem. Fortunately, with the scheduling, the Frogs were able to get in all three games and sweep BYU. The Frogs now sitting at 25-8 on the season, 8-4 in conference play. And for TCU, this was just a huge series where it was a good opportunity for the Frogs to really stretch out some of those wins in the Big 12 standings and gain some ground on some teams. And TCU did exactly what they were supposed to do this weekend.
This was one wacky weekend. I'll just say that. Like, not only the scheduling, but then that Friday game was just complete bonkers. So this was absolutely a must for the Frogs. They definitely wanted to get this series in two. Obviously, Ian, like you said, yeah, the weather was, you know, a big deal. Are we going to get the games in? And then obviously BYU, they can't play on Sunday. So that has, you know, a little bit of a makeshift thing there. And, yep, you know, and really having to settle your pitchers, get them out of a rhythm, get them to pitch on a Thursday, which they haven't done all year so far. Now, again, that kind of could be a benefit because they have to pitch on a Thursday next week, I believe. So that could be somewhat of an advantage. But this BYU series win and sweep, clearly a big thing, especially because they're going to have some pivotal Big 12 series coming up. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, most notably of that with Kansas, of course, this upcoming weekend. But yeah, I just want to kind of dive right into it. It's just been, it was a revelation for the TCU bats this weekend. We saw a lot of runs scored on both sides. A little bit of iffy pitching, as you mentioned, you know, down the stretch there. And of course, you're always going to get that when you try and cram two, you know, nine-inning games into one day and then try and play another game within 24 hours of those two games. But overall a lot of fight, a lot of grit, and a lot of guys just kind of sticking to their approach throughout the games. You know, in back and forth games like this, it really seems like, you know, you can get down on yourself pretty easily, and you know, once you give up a lead, it's hard to, you know, stick with the same type of approach. But it really felt like these bats, Ian, were really just, you know, disciplined and stuck to that approach and ended up in a pretty good result this weekend.
Yeah, you know, for TCU, again, I think coming into this weekend, I never want to put the expectation of saying, like, TCU should sweep this series. I'm always somebody that is like, yeah, win the series, You can drop one of three, but if you win every series of the season, you'll make it to Omaha and you'll win a national championship, right? But this weekend had something a little bit different. You're playing a team in BYU that comes in with one of the bottom three ERAs in the Big 12, the really struggling starting pitching and relief pitching as well. And it was just good to see TCU offensively firing on all cylinders, right? You got to see, I mean, Noah Franco 5-for-5 in game one between the double headers. Noah Franco went 8-for-19, then he went 9-for-13 on this series with, I believe, three RBIs or so. He was fantastic. It was really great to see Sawyer Strohsnyder as well back in the lineup after missing the Sunday against Houston last weekend and then the Tuesday against UTSA. That was really promising to get Strohsnyder back because we've talked about how much he struggled early on in the season, and now he's really found a groove. Strohsnyder is no longer on a hot streak. The guy's just a freak athlete, right? I mean, he is hitting the ball like crazy. You can put the shift on him to be a pole hitter in right field, but he showed it this series against BYU that he can slap it the other way as well. He can also hit into the shift and over the shift as well with a long ball or a line drive down the right field line. He is just in such a groove, and I think having him back in the lineup, it's not that TCU necessarily, you know, lives and dies with Strohsnyder in or out of the lineup, but it's another big bat, a lefty bat at that, for TCU to take advantage of, and they did. I mean, they played so well offensively at the plate. The discipline was crazy. The walks that TCU drew were insane. Again, they did their job, but sometimes doing your job is something that's hard to do. But TCU did enough, and they got the series sweep. So,
yeah, no, and to your point, I mean, Sawyer Strohsnyder wasted no time hitting a home run in the first game on Thursday and then hitting another home run in the second game on Thursday. But he just seems so comfortable now. And it's funny that, you know, after the first couple weekends, we were on here talking about how, you know, lost he's looked. It seems like it's been a whole season since then. He just has grown that much in these few games. But just an overall, like I said, an overall great approach from the lineup. Right now, currently, there are six guys on this team with at least 75 at-bats that have an on-base percentage above .415. And that's Sawyer Strohsnyder, Chase Brunson, Noah Franco, Carson Bowen, Cole Kramer, and then Nolan Traeger. And that just gives an extra level to this TCU team that they didn't really have last year. When you have so many guys consistently getting on at this rate, yeah, you're not going to get them in every single time with runners in scoring position. Yeah, you're not going to drive in every single runner. But being on base as often as they are is going to give you the opportunity to make those mistakes because they are eventually going to come through. And like we mentioned, with this many guys getting on base nearly half of the time that they step up to the plate, good things are going to happen. I hate to put it that simply, but it's just how it works. Another guy that was hitting the ball hard all weekend that I feel like kind of really, you know, slides under the radar a little bit is Chase Brunson.
Yep.
I mean, just an absolute huge home run to get TCU back into that game on Friday to cut the first six-run lead down. And then they actually had to come back from another six-run lead after that. But his steady bat in the lineup behind Sawyer Strohsnyder and, you know, in between Franco sometimes – It elongates this lineup so much.
I mean, I think the crazy thing was that Friday game, and you look at the pitching performance, right? It wasn't the best day out of the staff for the Horned Frogs. You know, Cademan Parker, maybe one of his weaker, obviously he's still coming back from injury and whatnot, but he had a great performance the week prior against Houston. So for him to have a letdown outing with only two innings pitched, gave up two hits, two earned runs, three walks, two strikeouts, normally at this point you're like, okay, Braden Sloan still hasn't pitched, okay, we still got him, but then he maybe had his worst outing of the season, and yet the Horned Frogs were still able to battle, and in this up and down game in which they were down six runs two different times during the game, it's just absolutely phenomenal. And obviously the guy that's not going to light it up, but I do want to throw a little bit of a shout out, was Jack Arthur, the pitch hit home run in that one. That was huge. Yeah. I'm more of a guy that, like, let the players get into a groove, right? Like, yeah, get them a couple
that's
ABs.
That's a hard first AB to take.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But to send so a guy in there to pitch it in that spot, oh, yeah, my gosh. That was great for him.
Yeah.
Hopefully, you know, he can get some more ABs, because I think that was just a moment where it's just, are you ready for the moment or not? He clearly showed there that, like, he stepped up, no pun intended, to the plate.
Yeah.
And, you know, made his moment shine, and I thought that was one of the biggest moments of that Friday game.
Yeah, it's I want to kind of talk about that Friday game as well, and you know, in the sense that, you know, the pitching was nowhere near what it was for each of the doubleheader games, right? You got to see in that first game of the doubleheader, Cole Klecker go four innings of two-hit baseball at that. He struck out six. Brassfield struggled a little bit in relief, giving up four runs and three and a third, but then Cade Udy got a save his third of the year. And then you look at game two, Tommy Lepore, no hitter through seven innings. Gianluca Shin comes in, does allow a hit, but the Frogs one hit the Cougars. The pitching on Friday really struggled, and you saw Cademan Parker struggle, but he came out after two innings, and I don't think it was because it's like it has nothing to do with, oh, he's not stretched out yet. I think it's the fact that, look, TCU used four relievers within the first two games, which is awesome. That was huge. And so Kirk Charles was like, there's no reason for me to leave this guy in here if things aren't going well. We can have the quick hook. We can pull these guys out quickly because we have so many guys to go to. I mean, he went to Shin in back-to-back days, right? And so, again, it's TCU set themselves up really, really well for that Friday game. And if they hadn't set themselves up for that Friday game, I'm not sure if they would have gotten back into it, because they just wouldn't have had the pitching had they not used only four relievers on the day of the doubleheader.
Completely agree. And we got to see kind of a budding star emerge in Caden Smith in that last game on Friday there. Came in and relief, three innings pitched, four Ks, no hits, no runs, and got his save, his first save of the season. And so it was just really impressive to see, you know, these young guys come in these different spots and see Sarlous, you know, mix and match and, you know, use guys in a little bit different spots and, you know, get them that comfortability in a Big 12 series against a team that can really swing it. But again, just kind of going back to the guys getting on base, I just wanted to, you know, note that this team drew 10 walks on Friday alone. I mean, we noted that BYU has, you know, some pretty horrendous pitching. They gave up a lot of free passes, as we noted. They hit a couple batters, but it wasn't just the BYU pitching staff. Yeah. It's kind of what I was getting at, because Cole Kramer reached base six times. He was 3-for-4, two RBI and three walks. And then, of course, you know, he was the hero, obviously, in the ninth, and then he was the hero in the 11th.
Yeah.
And then Carson Bowen went 8-for-13 across this series. He's really, really just excelled in this role where they find the right pitching matchups for him, and that's when he starts. And he's starting to kind of get into a groove like we saw during his freshman year toward the end and toward that stretch going into Omaha. So a lot of good signs. You even see Colton Griffin slug a three-run homer in his first game back. It's just kind of been – it was an overall good series for TCU fans just to feel good about this team going forward. And like we mentioned before, we kind of alluded to it, Kansas is playing some of the best baseball in the Big 12. They might be playing the best baseball in the Big 12 and some of the best baseball in the country. And that's a huge big-time matchup this weekend at Lupton. So we're really going to need that consistent approach against a Kansas team that is really outperforming expectations.
I mean, let's take a look at that standings real quick in the Big 12. TCU finds themselves now third in the standings. They climbed up, I think they were like fifth or sixth there, top echelon, you could say. But yeah, they play Kansas, you know, this upcoming weekend. They're first with a 9-3 Big 12 records, 27-6 overall. They're currently riding a six game winning streak. And then it's followed by West Virginia with a 7-3 Big 12 record and then a 27-4 overall record. They're also riding a five-game winning streak. So the top of the Big 12 right now, they're cooking. I mean, all of these teams have either a five-game winning streak or more. So it is going to be very competitive to get that top spot. And I think TCU, with that win against BYU, in which BYU finds themselves now at the bottom three of the Big 12 standings, that was a must-win. And it sets up a little bit of headlining matchup. You know, it could be top seeds, maybe as we get closer to that Big 12 tournament later the season. This could be one of those series that gets looked back upon in terms of, you know, analyzing this tournament and whatnot. So TCU obviously has to handle business tomorrow against UTA, and then they'll play the Jayhawks of Kansas. So it's going to be a big one.
Yeah, it's very interesting territory for Kansas baseball. Kansas baseball is not a program that necessarily, you know, is used to this kind of performance, right? At least at this point in the season. And, you know, Kansas just typically doesn't make headlines baseball wise, right? But they're 27-6. They're on a 9-game winning streak as well. 12-4 on the road. And the Frogs are fantastic at home. TCU this season, 14-4 at home. So it's going to be a clash for. It'll be interesting because I have a good feeling that these teams will also meet back again in the Big 12 tournament in Arlington for sure. But for TCU, it's going to be an adjustment because you're facing basically the polar opposite ends of the Big 12 in back-to-back weeks. You're facing a bottom barrel BYU team, and you're going to face a very hot, a very excited, a very vibes team right now in the Jayhawks that no one can really seem to stop. And for TCU, I think this is a good, not litmus test, but a good test at this point in the season where if you get a series win over Kansas at home, I think that can do numbers for the team going into the next month or so as you try to just get hot at the right time. We've talked about it, right? 2 years ago when TCU made the College World Series, that was one of the worst starts in program history to a season. TCU got hot at the perfect time and found their stride exactly where they needed to and then rode that into the College World Series, right? So and I know we're very far from that, and there's a lot of other issues even, you know, day-to-day, whether it's rotations or, you know, guys not hitting in the lineup. But I think for TCU, a big series win this weekend against Kansas could do a number. Changing gears, I want to get your guys' sense of this. I want to talk about the length of games in college baseball. Because, Jackson, I know you worked a game this weekend. I was on the call for all three against BYU. And not to say that a game under around 2 hours and 50 minutes is a long game, but we've gotten used to games being right around 2:30, 2:40. Both games on Thursday, so game one was 2 hours 53. Game two was 2 hours 55. And yes, with extras, it's definitely longer, but 4 hours and 38 on Friday. I think it's interesting because, okay, first of all, sorry, let me get your guys' thoughts. I'm curious, what do you guys think about college baseball and the length of these games?
Well, so I got to set a preface of the last two games I've worked pre and post for. It was that Saturday against Houston, the one that Frogs needed to get back into that series. That game, I think, went 3 hours and 30 minutes. Yep. And then I'm like, okay, that was the longest game of the year. Hopefully it will be the longest game of the year. And then we go back on this Friday game and it goes into extras. And of course, the most head-shaking way possible when they're down 6 twice. You're like, okay.
Yeah.
After they came back and then they went down, you know, down 12-6, you're like, okay, just throw in the towel. Let's just like, get out.
Let's get home early
this
today.
Game's over. And then, of course, it goes into extras. But, you know, it at least in the Houston game, it felt like there was a lot of pitching changes, and that drags it out. So and at least in this BYU game, there was some action, right? If you're a fan, that must have been one of the crazy experiences. But I just felt like it dragged on a little bit for sure.
Yeah, me too. And I know you've kind of touched on this, but with the no regulation of mound visits and certain, you know, the amount of times that you can come out and talk to your pitcher, it's really going to be hard for them to really cut down on this time. And then, as you know, they got to review every little thing too. And if a coach steps out of their dugout, then, you know, that ump is basically going to get, you know, screamed at until he you know reviews it, and then that's another delay. And but not even just talking about TCU games, because of course that Friday game was, you know, outrageously long. Thinking back to it, I was watching a BYU game last weekend. Okay. It was actually on March 29th against West Virginia, and that game was 19-16. And that game started at 1 o'clock Central Time and it ended at 5:35. So like that's 19 to 16, and it's only 4 hours and 40 minutes. That's actually, you know, relatively, you know, decent, you know, timing. But I just think that is kind of the standard that's being set in baseball with so many runs being scored. Yeah. There aren't that many great pitchers. You don't have a regulation on mound visits, how many times you can pull your pitcher. It's really just kind of going to be a mess until they sort all that out. But
so we can just blame BYU then. I think that's the consensus.
Seriously,
get better pitching.
It's really interesting because I mean I'll say this to you guys, and I have a feeling you guys will agree, but the pitch clock's great. I think the pitch clock is great, but it only works well if you actually use other forms to quicken the game. the pitch clock being instituted, having it 20 seconds before the pitcher has to throw the ball again, is only good if he can't throw over to first base five times in a row,
mm-hmm.
right? It's only good if you can't, if a manager can't pull a guy after just one batter,
right?
In the major leagues, you have to face three batters minimum, right? That keeps mm-hmm. the game going. It forces you to, yes, say, I'm putting in a pitcher for a matchup reason, but he's also going to have to face this righty or this switch hitter who's going to bat from the other side. And you're just going to have to deal with that, right? Goodness gracious, man. It's a piece of a puzzle that needs to get figured out. I'm not one that sits here and says, oh, I want baseball to be fast. But baseball's gotten longer than normal, I think. And that's where I'm saying baseball shouldn't get any longer. Baseball needs to stay the same or get quicker. But I'm also not sitting here like, I want to get out of the ballpark in 2 hours and 20 minutes. Us as normal baseball fans, I think the normal baseball fan is not going to be upset at a three-hour baseball game. It's just when it goes 3:30 and you're still playing nine innings, we're sitting here like, okay, pitch clock isn't working if you don't have other disengagements not being instituted, so...
Exactly, and I'm right there with you. The problem isn't that it's, the action is too long. It's, the actual action in the baseball game isn't the problem. It's everything in between, like we've mentioned, the mound visits and every little thing that the pitch clock that's stretching out all the time that we're not playing baseball, and it's making the entirety of the game a whole lot longer and just kind of drag on, saps all of the energy, all of the momentum that, one team might have. Just kind of kills all of that.
Yeah. So it should be a fun week for the Frogs as we move over back to TCU. The Frogs will be on the road, just down the road over at UT Arlington, taking on the Mavericks. The Mavericks this season, 9-19 on the year. The Frogs now sitting at 25-8. They're on a 6-game heater, taking on the UT Arlington Mavericks tomorrow, then coming back home to play the Kansas Jayhawks, who have won 9 in a row, including a series sweep over the UCF Knights down in Orlando. So it should be a fun week for TCU, a good test at the end of this week as well. So we'll have to wait for that. But we've still got a fantastic show left here tonight. Up next, we will talk about some women's March Madness. So stick right here. You're listening to Riff Ram Review on 88.7 The Choice.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. FeedThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard, so you don't need to ditch the car and start rollerblading to work.
I look ridiculous.
You look ridiculous!
You don't need to start foraging wild berries.
I was skeptical, but these are actually pretty good.
You don't need to sell your organs on the black market.
Lie back. This is gonna hurt.
Yeah, that hurts.
You don't need to rent out your apartment to drifters.
I made a fire with the wood in your bedroom.
That's my dresser!
And your closet door.
You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell all your belongings and live in a commune.
These dungarees belong to all of us now, Tom.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Riff Ram Review right here on 88.7 The Choice, your choice for college radio. Ian Napishan here, joined alongside by Jackson James and Luke Anderson as we make the pivot away from TCU baseball and back onto the basketball court with women's hoops talk, primarily TCU hoops, as we are going to do a little recap of this March Madness run for the Horned Frogs. Obviously, a week ago, TCU taking on the Texas Longhorns, the Frogs falling in Birmingham in the Elite Eight round of the Women's March Madness Tournament. But we do want to talk about this season, what the season has been for the Frogs, and also kind of talk about the win at Notre Dame and then the loss at Texas very briefly. We know that this is all very much old news, but we also kind of wanted to put a bit of a little bow on what was such a fantastic season. Gentlemen, we've talked about this team for so long. This team started out 2 years ago, right, in winning just 8 games on the season, having to host open tryouts last year. Now you get into an Elite Eight. And honestly, I think the loss to Texas was one of the easiest games to flush out because I was just so thrilled that we were there. It was a tough game to watch. Was not the easiest, watch as well. I think, it was... I mean, TCU played a very good Longhorns team that definitely deserved to go through. But, yeah, what are you guys' thoughts on this season as we're, you know, definitely obviously now a full week removed from, you know, TCU getting knocked out?
Yeah, obviously never want to lose to Texas of all teams to end your season, but I'm kind of right there with you where it wasn't as big of a pill to swallow. Just knowing where this team came from and where this program came from, and obviously we've talked about it, you know, nonstop on this show. Just how Mark Campbell has just completely revitalized this culture. So I know him and his coaching staff and that locker room and those players. Obviously, they're not, you know, content with this at all. But they are absolutely, you know, proud of themselves and where they got, and they should be, because of course, as we've noted, they've just, you know, been setting milestones and breaking records all year for this program. But yeah, like you mentioned, just fell into a really difficult matchup against a great defensive Texas team. Yeah. that forced TCU into a season-high 21 turnovers and really just made life difficult for the Frogs all night. Could not get into a rhythm at all, and just really struggled with those active hands and that elite defense that Texas played.
I will say it was super cool, like the whole experience, right? It's hard to it's hard not to take it for granted because it ends so quickly. Yep. But to see, like, we were at, Ian and I were at Buff Bros watching the game.
Yep.
And like that was packed. That was the fun. We went to a watch party
for the Notre Dame game, which we, you know, like I told Jackson, I said never in a million years did I think we would go to a women's basketball watch party at my 4 years in TCU, and I'm so glad we did. But I never would have thought we would have, just because that's not what TCU women's basketball has never been this, right? And to get to experience that's crazy.
I mean, my first year, I remember I was doing working game cam, the main camera for TCU women's basketball. I think they played Florida that game, and they got like dogged by 40 points.
Goodness.
And it was really bad, really a bad watch. And now you look at it now, and they're making headlines all over the place. Yeah. It was super cool. And yeah, like Luke, like you said, that Texas game was definitely a little rough. It seemed like they were a little overwhelmed. I mean, just the countless 5-second violations that was really just set me off. I was like, ugh, you can miss shots, you can even have turnovers, but turnovers like that was just really frustrating. But yeah, you got to give props to that Texas team. I mean, unfortunately, they fell in the Final Four, but they were still one of the best teams in the nation with 35 wins, only 3 losses. Just truly one of the best Texas teams, you know, it feels like in a while. But yeah, this TCU team, it's going to be, you know, an interesting transition for sure going into next year, just because you had so many, you know, grad students, so many seniors on the team and whatnot. But that's also what made this, you know, this was like the TCU version of the Last Dance.
Yep.
Right? It's like their last opportunity, you know, to really make a move with all the transfers. And, you know, obviously you have your star in Haley Van Lith come to this team, which who would have thought she would have been here, right? Isn't that crazy?
Insane. I mean,
seeing her in the national, or not, the Elite Eight last year with LSU and be like, dang, this girl, obviously a little bit of a flame out, and then was able to rejuvenate herself, recreate her image a little bit, which is another great aspect to the season. And I think that's just like a nice little TCU charm with it as well, right? We're a private school with, what, 1,100, 1,200 undergrad students, yeah, right? And compared to Texas, which has, I don't even know, I want to say like 50,000.
At least. Yeah.
So it was just great to see, you know, them represent our school so proudly. And, you know, I think they got the media respect that they deserved.
Yeah, I mean, I know we talk about transfers a lot, right? We talk about how TCU has a very old team, right? A very experienced team. But and maybe people are thinking about this too, but it's the fact that TCU literally committed themselves to this season being it, going all in for this year. They did not recruit a single high school player. There were no freshmen on this team at all. Mark Campbell did not say, I want a high school player to come to this team. It was full-on transfer portal. And TCU did a fantastic job, and TCU has made itself a desirable program for others to come to in the very near future. I'm very excited to see what happened. The Frogs have already been dabbling in the transfer portal already. It opened up, I want to say, 2 Tuesdays ago, so 13 days ago to today as we're recording this on Monday. But, you know, for TCU, I mean, you talk about it, right? It's a very different school that has been on the map now for several different sports. I mean, obviously, baseball is one of the biggest sports here that is always nationally acclaimed. Football a couple years ago, obviously, in the CFP run and making it to the Natty. And then now for TCU Women's Hoops, who never in a million years did I think that a TCU women's basketball program could have made this sort of run. And I mean, goodness, I mean, we're just so fortunate to even have been here to like witness this, because my goodness, it was a heck of a season. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And to your point exactly, while there may not be a lot of continuity, you know, with the names on the roster going into next year, there's still just so much hope for Frog fans. And I know that, you know, TCU fans are well aware of that, seeing the work that Mark Campbell is already putting in the portal right now. But I kind of just want to touch on, you know, what you mentioned, where TCU, we never would have expected this when we got here 4 years ago, right? But that, I think, is just the charm of this small school being in a power conference with the athletic restrictions or the athletic availability yeah. of a Power Five school. You know, we're afforded all these resources to go out and get these players, and Mark Campbell has afforded these resources to go out and get these players. But most of all, what fuels his recruiting approach is the culture that he has set here. He connects with his players. We saw it time and time again this year with Haley Van Lith, how close he was to her, but and to not just her, but everyone on the team. He has players already, some of the best players in the country already reaching out to him that want to play for TCU. And we've said it before too, TCU may not have, you know, the same lucrative NIL packages for women's basketball that a South Carolina, that a UConn, that an LSU might have. But again, it's that Mark Campbell culture. It's the real personal belief and genuine desire for you know people in that program to want to get better. They truly care about you, and I feel like Mark Campbell, since the second he stepped foot on campus, made that his first priority. And we've seen the great things that have come from it already, and we're already starting to hear the good things that might continue. Because like we mentioned, we didn't have any idea that Haley Van Lith was on the radar at all last year, at all around this time yeah. last year. So who knows what kind of, you know, big time commitments could be coming in the next few weeks.
Yeah, Mark Campbell did a fantastic job, fully recognized by the folks here in the Big 12 and on campus, but not recognized by our friends over at the AP, Bush unfortunately. League. Yeah, Corey Close for UCLA Women's Hoops winning the Coach of the Year award. I mean, congratulations, full congratulations, but we've got to be biased. We've got to make our stand. Goodness gracious, AP. What's going doing? On here, man?
I just we saw. I remember seeing the finalists and seeing all the comments and just be like, "Oh, Mark's got this in the
bag." Everybody said Mark had it.
Everyone was like, "Oh, he's got it." And then to see him not get it, I just feel like that was just like, "Come on!" It's like, ugh, because it's just obviously UCLA. They had a great year.
Yes.
You can't. They were number one at multiple points during the season. They had a great year. But if you're talking about Coach of the Year, right, dating back to like the end of last season, the transition. Well, again, with the turmoil that they had to deal with last season, the injuries, having open tryouts, right? Not almost having to forfeit two games because they didn't have enough healthy players on the roster to not only win the Big 12 regular season, but also win the tournament, the Big 12 tournament,
yeah.
and then not win this award, I think, has just complete malpractice of the profession.
What I would love to hear what more Mark Campbell in this program would have had to have done for him to win this award, because it's just crazy.
He finished apparently second with 5 votes. He was outvoted by 11 votes, so 11 people thought that he was not the Coach of the Year in comparison to UCLA's coach, which is
Corey,
interesting.
Yep, Corey Close.
Yeah, the biggest thing for me is just I feel like most of these awards, but especially Coach of the Year award. We see this a lot of times in professional sports, but I feel like specifically Coach of the Year awards should be based on the expectations of your team. Yeah. And UCLA was expected to be a top 5 team at the beginning of the year. I mean, obviously TCU was, 11th at the beginning of the year? They were up there. It might have been, I might have messed that up, but they were up there, but nowhere near the same breath that UCLA was in. UCLA was a national championship contender from the get-go.
Yeah.
It took a few games for everybody to hop on the TCU train. I just feel like the expectations do matter, especially in this race. But, who's to say?
Yeah, and then now you talk about expectations, right? Looking into next year, well, man, ESPN, another blunder here. Their way too early top 25 does not include the TCU Horned Frogs. Goodness. Again, so once again, TCU is going to have to prove their haters wrong. The Frogs were not taken nearly as seriously coming into this year, but also surprised a lot of people. And then now going into the 2025-2026 season, they are no longer in the way too early top 25. So hopefully TCU can continue to wreak havoc among women's college hoops analysts, because they're pretty good at doing that. And yeah, just kind of surprising. Anything on that, you guys?
Oklahoma State is in there. Oklahoma State. Come on. Again, it's obviously in the title of the way too early.
Yeah.
Right. So you got to give it some time, especially the transfer portal just opened. Let me see when they released these. It was April 6th. So yesterday when they released it. So it's been what, like you said, 12 days. They've had the transfer portal open for 12 days when they published this. So who knows? Maybe it was crafted a couple of days before and then they just published it. So it would be interesting to see if TCU's making the headlines, you know, at the end of April. Maybe when, you know, Mark Campbell has a better vision of his team coming up next year. So that's at least where I'll put that for right now.
Yeah. And then I guess finally rounding it out, we haven't even mentioned it, though, but UConn taking down South Carolina 82-59 in the March Madness National Championship. Heck of a game. I watched about the first three quarters, then I was driving home for the fourth. But congratulations to Paige Beckers. I think that's freaking awesome. Taking down South Carolina is not an easy feat, as we know. But for UConn, the two seed coming in and beating South Carolina, who got off to a very slow start in the tournament, finally found their way. They beat Texas in the Final Four, and then taking on UConn. But, man, UConn was firing on all cylinders yesterday and ended up winning the Natty. So congratulations to UConn and Paige Beckers.
Yeah, just a dominant run from UConn there. And we talked about it before the show. But, yeah, I'm really happy for Paige Beckers finally getting a national championship. But domination is probably, like, you know, the even an understatement, because they beat the living crap out of UCLA in the Final Four, and then they beat South Carolina like they weren't even another one seed. Not much more analysis you can give on that other than just a complete dominant run by UConn.
I think it's just also a big shame on the Juju Watkins injury, just because, not saying that UConn wouldn't have been able to get past her or past USC if she was healthy. But I think that's just, you know, it's a missed opportunity for such a great matchup, right? Obviously, USC was still able to get into the position of the Elite Eight. And you even saw on, you know, the pregame shows and whatnot, how they were talking about how USC got the bad draw out of the one seeds, how that you want to face this UConn team. Well, that brings up, you know, you have Paige Beckers going out to the league, her final ride, right? She's probably going to be the number one pick in the WNBA draft. And then you have this Juju girl who's really starting to become the new face of college basketball on the women's side. She is, if you haven't seen her play, go watch some highlights, because that girl is very good at the game of basketball. And so for her to go in, go down with an injury, especially such a big injury as well, that could affect her season, at least at the start, maybe. Hopefully she won't have to miss a season. I mean, Paige Beckers had a similar injury with a torn ACL, so maybe there can be some advice there, but you know, that is an unfortunate part, but UConn definitely proved that they were easily the best team, Luke, like you said, dominating UCLA and then dominating South Carolina.
Yeah, so that will do it for our women's basketball talk. I'm sure we'll talk TCU hoops again as the transfer portal continues to make some movements, as the Frogs continue to make movements throughout the transfer portal as well. We will take a break, though, and switch things back over to the men's side of things. Frogs hoops roundup as well. We're going to talk about the transfer portal for TCU men's basketball. Ernest Udeh leaving the Frogs and heading over to Miami. And just doing a little roundup there as well to kind of tie a nice bow on the end of the men's basketball season before we talk about the March Madness side of things as well. So stick right here. You're listening to Riff Ram Review on 88.7 The Choice.
Today, my new dad and I shot off a rocket in the park.
Today, my new son and I failed to shoot off a rocket.
He knew exactly what to do.
I had no clue what I was doing.
We set up the rocket.
Hit ignition.
And then
nothing. Sometimes I laugh when I'm frustrated.
Then out of nowhere, the rocket launched into the air.
The rocket did get into the air.
I've never seen anything fly so high.
And then crashed into a kite.
Look out! Look out!
And then the pond.
I'll never forget that day.
I'll never forget that day, even if I tried.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of kids in foster care will take you just as you are. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Refer and Review right here on 88.7 The Choice, your choice for college radio. Ian Napetian here, joined alongside by Jackson James and Luke Anderson as we transition from women's hoops over to TCU men's basketball, kind of rounding out this season and looking into the transfer portal now, as the portal has been open for a little bit of time now. And joining us, as always, is our men's hoops guru, Luke Anderson. Luke,
thank you. Welcome back in.
TCU has been active in the portal. They've already gotten two players, Jaden Pierre and Brock Harding, from Providence and Iowa, respectively. And I'm curious to hear your kind of breakdown of these guys and maybe what TCU maybe can focus on in the portal, trying to get better in certain areas. Also, retaining guys is a big topic as well as of late. So I'm just curious to hear what you think about, I guess, Jaden Pierre or Brock Harding or wherever you want to go. But TCU hoops, there's a lot of moving pieces in this offseason, and it should give TCU fans some bit of excitement.
Yeah, no, I guess we can go ahead and just kind of jump into to the two transfer portal commitments that TCU has already picked up and kind of give a quick little rundown and, you know, how TCU might plan to use each of them. But yeah, so these were two guys in Brock Harding and Jaden Pierre that the TCU coaching staff was very, very adamant about getting contact with early and getting them to campus early, so that they could get these guys to commit, because these were two of their top guys in the portal, and these were two of the first targets that they actually named. So A lot of criticism of TCU's offense in the past has been, you know, how it kind of stalls out and how it can be a little one dimensional. And if you're not getting plays out of action, then you don't really have a lot of creative freedom to score in other ways. Well, Jaden Pierre definitely, you know, kind of models this move toward a more modernized approach that TCU is trying to add to their offense. I've heard that the offense might be looking to include a little bit more DHO, a little more zoom action. That's dribble handoff and zoom action. This is, again, a very modernized, you know, offensive philosophy that you're seeing a lot of teams today excel with. A lot of the best teams excel with. But Jaden Pierre, he's more of an off-ball guard. He comes off a lot of those dribble handoffs that I talked about. But he really excels in spot-up positions. He can attack closeouts well. He's a 57% shooter at the rim. So, again, just kind of a theme with TCU is guys that can really attack the rim and convert at a high rate. We saw last year we had a lot of guys that could get to the rim. The conversion rate at the rim wasn't necessarily the same that it's been in the past when we had, you know, some elite scorers at the rim. You know, think about the likes of Mike Miles, Micah Peavy, Emmanuel Miller, you know, all those guys. But last couple of years, kind of taken a step back in terms of the elite ability to get to the rim. They placed a lot of emphasis on that in their search in the portal. And so, yes, Jaden Pierre is a guy that can attack those closeouts. Like I said, though, he is going to be more of an off-ball guard. So he's going to catch, and then he's going to rip, and he's going to look for his spots. But another interesting, you know, just, you know, attribute to his arsenal is the fact that he has some really, really deep range. He might have, you know, some of the deepest range that we've had, you know, in TCU men's basketball in a minute. Maybe since Trey Tennyson. I know it's only been a season or two, but feels like a while.
Yeah.
But he made more 19 threes from 25 feet or more last year. So he's got the green light and he's got the confidence. But yeah, definitely more of a catch and shoot shooter. And then in the passing game or in the you know point guard game, he's a very good passer. He's a great lob thrower. He's only got about an 18% assist rate, so he's certainly going to look for his first. Like I said, you know, more of a two guard than a one. But yeah, no. So Jaden Pierre, I'm very excited for in kind of that combo guard in that two role. But then Brock Harding is certainly more of a lead guard. I mean, he's an elite passer. He's one of he has one of the highest assist rates in the country at a 33% assist rate. That's 88th percentile. He's very, very patient navigating ball screens. I mean, once he gets into that paint, he's really, really good at keeping that guy on his back and really just reading the defense and kind of deciding where to go with the ball. He's great at finding shooters, and he's great at making crisp bounce passes in the lane. So really going to be crucial for you know, Malik Diallo and David Punch and, you know, whatever other center we bring in the portal to really be ready for some crisp passes and work on their hands. Because, again, we have an elite passer in Brock Harding stepping foot on campus. But he is a little bit turnover prone, so you're probably going to see them alternate like we did last year with Noah Reynolds and Vashawn Ouellette, yeah. Sharing those on-ball duties. But yeah, again, Brock Harding, another exceptional three-point shooter. He's another guy where he's certainly a better shooter off the catch and shoot. Both these guys aren't necessarily going to be elite pull-up guys. That's not necessarily their game to ISO and take a shot from the outside. But they're very, very capable catch and shooters. Both above average percentages from three. And I can just run you through those percentages here. But actually just harkening back to Jaden Pierre, he shot 35% from three, 40% from the field on 12 points, three rebounds, and three assists. And then Brock Harding this last year shot about 40% from three as well on 8 points and five rebounds. So just two guys that are going to share the backcourt duties, and going to provide a lot of depth, to that ball handling, lead guard role.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what's going to be interesting too is, you know, again, we talked about it so much. I mean, we harped on it almost every time we talked about men's hoops this season, but this last year took so much of a time for the guys to gel, I think, and maybe find the right rhythm because there's so many new faces. But I think in addition to getting guys in the portal, it's going to be equally as important for TCU to work on not only retaining guys, but developing the guys that are here and that will be here to stay, right? I think maybe one of the things that I feel as a TCU basketball fan is just that our development is not nearly as good as other schools. You can get good talent, you can recruit okay, but then getting them better in the program is kind of where that struggle bus begins. And I'm curious just to see how that gets on, because TCU does have a lot of young talents, you know, that are promising, but maybe now, again, I kind of called it an unproven talent just because they haven't played a ton. But now you get a full offseason with some of these new guys and a whole year under a lot of these guys' belts as well. Even a second year for some of them too, like Jace Posey, who's coming back. And now you can maybe set a higher expectation because it's, hey, we've been here, we've done this. Let's really go attack this season and see what we can do.
Exactly. And I think a huge part in that is that TCU returned four scholarship players that played minutes last year in Micah Robinson, David Punch, Jace Posey, and Malik Diallo. And that was a clear emphasis. Because as you've noted, it seems like the development, you know, here and there is a little spotty. You know, we're constantly losing transfers that go and perform at other schools, a la Shahade Wells, a la Jacoby Coles, yeah. A la PJ Haggerty. Yeah. The list goes on and on. I think the emphasis was for this coaching staff to keep these guys on campus for more than just 2 years,
yeah.
Like even more than just this upcoming year. We saw how well that helped guys like Emmanuel Miller, how well, yes, that helped guys like Micah Peavy. Getting these guys in this system for more than just 1 year, I've mentioned it so much on this show, I feel like, but the defensive system is a complete learning curve from anything that these guys had played in high school. So you were going to see those lapses in time at times last year where TCU would give up a kill shot run to the other team and then take themselves out of the game entirely and end up losing by 25 to 30 points. And that stuff just happens with these young guys. But that's why I think the emphasis this offseason was, hey, we're going to get complementary pieces. We're going to get a Brock Harding who's great at finding his teammates and putting his teammates in easier positions or better positions to succeed. We're going to get a Jaden Pierre, a very, very capable shot maker, an elite attacking guard who can take some of the pressure off these young guys. But like I said, the main emphasis this offseason is developing Micah Robinson, is developing David Punch, Jace Posey, Malik Diallo. Those guys are going to be crucial for the team next year because they've got big plans for them. You already see David Punch putting in way more work on his jump shot. You already see Micah Robinson. There are reports that he's already grown an inch or two. He's up to about 6'7", 6'8", now. That would be huge for TCU this year. Get a little added weight and a little added height to the wing depth. I just think guys like that getting an extra year in the system, not only bulking up, like I said, in the weight room, but really learning this defensive system. Because once you learn the defensive system and once you're more comfortable in it, then you're able to just play a little bit more free. Yeah. And that's on the offensive end or the defensive end. So very, very excited to see what those four bring to the table. And then a couple of red shirts last year that are also supposed to be coming back in RJ Jones and Ashton Simmons. I'm a huge fan of Ashton Simmons. This guy puts in a ridiculous amount of work. RJ Jones also puts in a ridiculous amount of work. Those two guys were in the gym nonstop all this year. They didn't play a single minute this year, and they were still getting shots up more than anybody. And it just seems like those two guys have the work ethic and the ability to be, some of those former red shirts of the past that TCU would lose in the portal, and they'd go off and they would succeed elsewhere. Seems like those guys are kind of making the same strides, but we're getting to retain them next year. Ashton Simmons is a very, very smart player. He's a great ball handler. He's a fantastic passer. He's going to be elite in the pick and roll, and I'm just very, very excited to see what he can do. And then RJ Jones, an elite shooter from the outside, needs to work a little bit more on his point guard role and his ability to pass the ball without creating so many turnovers. But if he can put on the weight like it seems like he has a little bit, he's going to be an elite shooter for this team next year. So I'm excited to see what it has in store, because there are a lot of fun names on this team.
So we've talked a lot about what's happening on the court. Now for you, how about this? We don't talk about the behind-the-scenes stuff. How is it for you now that you don't have to really travel for now? What is your schedule looking like now that kind of the season's been wrapped up for the last few weeks?
Yeah, been a little bit different.
Okay, I was going to say.
It's funny. It's like a complete mind frame shift.
Yeah, yeah.
Because obviously, you're in the gym all the time. And obviously we're still in the gym now, but it kind of shifts to more of an operations side where we're doing a lot of scouting these guys in the portal, and then we'll get a call to come out and help David Punch rebound. So it's just kind of on call for everything. A little bit more of a disorganized schedule. Coaches are going in and out every day. Yeah. Coaches are in LA one day and they're in New Jersey the next, but. Yeah, no, it's an exciting time. Seeing a lot of progress from players already. A lot of guys that are really, really committed to getting better. So disappointing season this past year, but some hopeful things that I've seen so far in summer workouts.
I mean, that's the one thing you gotta like about the transfer portal is the guys that stay. They want to stay, right? They want to stay. They want to develop. They trust the coaches. They like the atmosphere, at least, right? If they didn't like Fort Worth, they didn't like DCU, they'd probably get the heck out of here, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing I'm looking forward to, is the guys that stayed and how they develop. And, because this, it was a down year, right? And so it's like, okay, how do we push past this? How do we rebuild our brand almost? It's almost like they need to go through a little bit of a rebranding. Like you said, new schemes, it seems like the trajectory of this team is going. And so it's a little bit of a change, but I think it's a must needed change, right? And so I think that's another aspect of this TCU basketball men's team that is another fascinating aspect of how it's going to change.
Yeah, should be a fun, very interesting next couple of months as TCU basketball has some time off in terms of not playing any games that mean anything, but working hard in the offseason to try to get back to where this Horned Frogs team knows that it can get back to. So, Luke, thank you so much. We love the insight. It's always fun getting to learn about what's going on with this team and some very in-depth takeaways as well. Having you talk about men's hoops is always a pleasure. So we appreciate that. Folks back home, we're going to take a very quick break, but we'll be right back to talk some March Madness. The national championship is going on tonight at 7:50 Central Time. It will be Florida and Houston. Should be a very interesting game. We've got a lot to say about the Final Four recaps, but stick it right here. We'll be back in a 60-second break to come back here for some more March Madness talk, this time on the men's side. So you're listening to Riff Ram Review on 88.7, KTCU The Choice, your choice for college radio.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. FeedThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard, so you don't need to ditch the car and start rollerblading to work.
I look ridiculous.
You look ridiculous!
You don't need to start foraging wild berries.
I was skeptical, but these are actually pretty good.
You don't need to sell your organs on the black market.
Lie back. This is gonna hurt.
Yeah, that hurts.
You don't need to rent out your apartment to drifters.
I made a fire with the wood in your bedroom.
That's my dresser!
And your closet door.
You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell all your belongings and live in a commune.
These dungarees belong to all of us now, Tom.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
This is TCU women's basketball player Sedona Prince, and you're listening to KTCU 88.7 FM Fort Worth. Go Frogs!
Welcome back into Riff Ram Review right here on KTCU, the choice, your choice for college radio. Jackson James, joined alongside Luke Anderson and Ian Napetian. And now it's time to talk about this men's national championship in basketball. Come down to the final game of the season between the Florida Gators and the Houston Cougars. Florida currently a 1.5-point favorite, pretty much a pick 'em here. And what a crazy, scenario tonight. What a crazy outcomes in the Final Four. Let's dive a little bit into that. Let's start on the Florida side, in which they defeated the number one seed Auburn Tigers. No, I'm tripping. War Eagle. They defeated them 79-73. Florida really got control in this one. Luke, what was the one takeaway you think from this Florida win?
I think the big thing in this one is kind of the nation. If they hadn't already been introduced, they were introduced to Walter Clayton and his late game magic. I mean, this guy took over and scored 34 points and was just hitting every single shot down the stretch. It felt like he could get to the rim at will, and then he would take the craziest sidestep, step back three-pointers over three defenders, and just it really seemed like he was hitting dagger after dagger when Auburn would make a little bit of a push to get right back. And I think that huge second half from Florida was all the difference. I mean, in the first half, they were outscored by 8 points, and it seemed like Auburn was just outworking them, out-hustling them. They were getting every rebound. It seemed like they were just playing a lot more team basketball than Florida was. But then Florida got right back to what they do best, which like I said, is that offensive rebounding and attacking the glass and just playing with their hair on fire, because when that Florida team is active in the passing lanes and when they're playing with purpose on the defensive end, playing with purpose and energy, then they can really turn into that juggernaut that we saw toward the last month of the season this year, and they got the huge win over Auburn, and they face a very difficult Houston team tonight.
I was shocked. I showed up to watch this game right when there was 3 minutes left in that first half. And to see Auburn up, I was a little shocked. I was like, I was really high on this Florida team. I have them in a couple brackets winning it all. And Auburn was in firm control. But yeah, like you said, that huge second half by Florida, they outscored Auburn 41-27 in that second half. And Walter Clayton Jr., that I saw some, one of the analysts during the halftime show or during in between games, he was talking about how teams should select him with the second overall pick in the draft after obviously Cooper Flagg, and obviously the NBA teams don't necessarily love to draft older guys, but I would love to have this guy on my team. He just seems like he has it. I feel like everyone kind of talks about, do you have it? And I think Walter Clayton Jr., he just has a knack of stepping up in the moment, you know, when it's needed most for this team. He was asked, you know, in a, I think it was a post-game press conference, it was like, do you step up in these moments? Do you know when to turn it on, or does it just naturally happen? And he was like, it just happens. You know, my teammates get me the ball, and put me in a position to succeed. He went 11 of 18 from the field, 5 threes on the night in 8 attempts, finished with 34 points. Dude is, and again, it's a great Florida team, but he also puts this team on its back, and it is just absolutely, you know, what a sight to behold. He's kind of been the story so far of this March Madness tournament, especially in terms of a player profile. I mean, Cooper Flagg, he's had some great moments, and we'll get into that in the next game. Walter Clayton Jr., insane. Now, I want to talk about the Auburn sign a little bit. And Johnny Broome. This guy, and the reason why I bring him up, it may be like, what? It felt like he was the go-to guy for Auburn throughout the first half, and then he cooled down in the second half. He finished with only 15 points on the game. I think he had 10 in that first half. And so that was a little bit let down for the Auburn Tigers. And I just think this was an unfortunate miss. They've been, you know, kind of in the top 25 for the last couple of seasons. And, you know, to get into San Antonio was just, they kind of just dropped the ball a little bit, especially in that second half.
Yeah, no, you're right. The past few seasons, they've had some very, very well-constructed teams that like this year, can shoot the mess out of the ball, and they can also defend at a high level. But unfortunately, tonight, they just didn't get enough stops. And I think it's important that you mentioned Johnny Broome, because in the first half, I mean, he was tearing it up, and that obviously, you know, led to why Auburn took the lead at half. But, you know, playing on a little bit of a banged up elbow, a little bit just banged up toward the end of the season in general, it seemed like he was kind of slowing down toward the end, and that they would send that late double that would really kind of give him fits, and it made some other guys kind of have to step up, but they were having to step up out of rhythm, because again, they wouldn't let Broome get to that spot in the post where he could kind of initiate the offense. And so when you kind of throw that out of rhythm and just throw a bunch of looks at him in that spot, it's really just going to cause all sorts of mistakes for a team that typically just, you know, functions like a well-oiled machine. But yeah, just a disappointing game from Tahad Pettiford, only 7 points on 1 of 6 shooting. That guy had been a stud throughout the last 3 to 4 rounds, just making big shot after big shot. But yeah, no, I think it's important to mention that Florida neutralized Broome, and that essentially, and then they upped their effort entirely, across the board. And that was the deciding factor in this game, I think. And then of course, like you said, Walter Clayton just going into takeover mode. And I love that the, you know, the country is starting to kind of get to hear his story, because he really is a really cool story, because he was a 4-star football prospect out of high school. He actually had offers from Florida, Florida State, Notre Dame, Georgia, Tennessee. This guy could be, you know, playing on Sundays, but he might end up, you know, like you said, sneaking into that first round. It's really going to be hard to convince these draft scouts. I don't care if he's 22, that he's not a first round pick after his performance. And if he puts up another big one tonight against Houston, then he'll really solidify that case, I think.
I mean, that would be a crazy story, especially as, you know, the NBA season comes to a close and teams are starting to think about the draft and whatnot. It's just interesting to see what storylines they push out in tonight's game. But I think one they're going to keep going back to is this Houston-Duke game. If you didn't see it, I'll basically just say what you need to know. Duke had a 96.2% chance to win with 2 minutes and 21 seconds left in this game. They were up, I believe, 9 with 3 minutes to go. They were up, really, they were up 11 with around 8 minutes left to go in the second half. And maybe one of the biggest chokes, biggest comebacks I've ever seen in sports, just generally. I think that was the magnitude of this game. Just seeing, you know, it felt like it was over. It was like, oh, okay, Duke's going to get it. I mean, they deserved it, right? They're a great team, got a great, really great roster, not only just Cooper Flagg, but some other guys as well. Knipple, what a name that was. I found out yesterday. We were loving that. But
we or you?
No, the people I was with, the people I was with. But this was just, I want to give it up to you guys, because I just think this was an all-timer for sure.
That was a crazy game. I was only fortunate enough to watch the second half, but I'm glad I caught the second half. When I forgot who it was that had the putback dunk, but when the putback dunk was put up, I was like, oh boy.
Yeah, totally.
That was an impressive dunk, and I don't know, it was just crazy. I was at a party watching it, and it was the one time at the party where everybody stopped what they were doing and just, it was silent, and we're all watching the game. A bunch of Houston fans were there, so it made it a fun environment. Thank gosh there were no Duke fans, or else I think that would have ruined it. But goodness gracious, Houston, that was a crazy comeback. And again, like, I know we're not supposed to be like big fans of other Big 12 teams, but I like the Big 12 representation big time because it's huge for our conference. And we saw what Kevin Sampson said after the game, right? You know, saying that, look, going 34-4 while being in the Big 12 is not an easy thing to do. We talk about how good the Big 12 is across all major sports. And it's great to see that Big 12 is getting represented in the national championship tonight.
Yeah, absolutely love that for Kelvin Sampson. I mean, he deserves this more than anyone. He just is just an absolute, in my opinion, he's been the best coach in the sport for the past 3 years. And, you know, he's kind of letting the nation know why that is. And I think he's just finally getting his flowers, like I said, from the entire country. But really, this comeback kind of helped solidify that because they have been doing this all year. I mean, this is a team that went 19-1 in the Big 12. I mean, he said it himself. He didn't go 34-4 in the Toy Poodle League. All right, he went 34-4 in the Big 12. All right, he just has implemented a culture of never say die, scratch, claw, fight, give it your all until the very end. And there's just something kind of special, kind of heartwarming about that, especially in this day and age in college basketball and just sports in general, where it seems like athletes nowadays kind of have a little bit more, you know, ego to them. That this culture that has been built at Houston is entirely selfless. There's no egos there, and it thrives on the ability to just give that relentless effort, that relentless pressure, that undying will until the very end of the game. We saw them do this to Kansas on Kansas's home floor, one of the hardest places to play in college basketball. We saw them do this exact same thing to them and come back in a flurry. And that's why it is a very big collapse by Duke, but I want all the credit for this to go to Kelvin Sampson, because when you come back multiple times like that in a season, and the blueprint has been showed every single night in every single game, that's not a fluke, right? Like that, like, yes, Duke made one shot in the final 10 minutes. Yes, that is a collapse to those standards. But Houston made them make one shot. Like, that Houston was the reason that they made one shot. And Houston has gone on these kill shot runs all year. They finished the game on a 25-8 run. 25-8 run in the last 8 minutes. They were down 14 with 8:10 to play, and they go on a 25-8 run to win 70-67. And like you mentioned, that putback dunk after getting the inbound steal, just playing great defense, denying Cooper Flagg, making it tough for Sion James to inbound the ball there, getting that deflection. Malik Wilson goes out, takes the three, he misses. But what does Houston do better than any team in the country? They offensive rebound better than any team in the country. They fight till the end better than any team in the country, and that's just exactly what they did. So it's just, I've loved Houston all year. I've loved Kelvin Sampson for a long time. Obviously, the Houston connection, I've got a little bit of a bias toward that. But I think that what he's done, specifically with this group of guys, we talk about it all the time, changing faces, changing names on the roster every single year. Kelvin Sampson prioritized keeping his guys. He went out and he got Milos Uzam from Oklahoma, who has turned out to be a fantastic lead guard. He hasn't replaced Jamal Shedd, but he's come in and he's been as important, if not, you know, just as important, you know, as Jamal Shedd was last year. And so just all these things kind of just just culminate in just an elite culture that I don't think we're really going to be able to replicate in this kind of era of college basketball. So I really just wanted to give props to Kelvin Sampson and his Houston program. But of course, still a phenomenal game from Cooper Flagg with 27 points, kind of doing it all. And then he had that shot over Juwan Roberts, backed him down, fade in the paint, you know, with about 4 seconds left, and he just missed it front rim. So they had the ball in the player, the best player's hands, you know, and they got the shot that they wanted. I thought they could have used a little more creativity, a little more motion in that last play. Seems like that's kind of been the thing with Duke all year. They get a little stagnant in those last second possessions. But yeah, it's all a testament to Houston, and I just wanted to give them props. So going to be an elite matchup tonight. Excited for it.
Yeah, I think the Cooper Flag thing, I think his stock, it couldn't even go higher before the game, but I think it went, it skyrocketed. It broke the charts.
Yeah,
that crazy finish he had under the hoop,
oh,
reverse spun on the like back square of the rim. It was just like, it's hard to describe, but it was whimsical. It was like a whole,
and he's like 6'11". No, it's ridiculous.
His final stats, like you said, Luke, 27 points, but he had 4 assists, 2 steals, 7 rebounds. He was just doing it all out there.
Filling it up.
Now, I'm not trying to be a biased guy here, but if you see a trend throughout this season, he has had a struggle closing games. Now, that, if you want to have a negative on him, I think that would be the one negative. Now, again, is that situational? Absolutely, right? It's not. I don't think it's going to happen every time, and he was maybe 3 feet from hitting a game-winning shot there. That is one thing to pay attention to. I mean, this is going to be like another LeBron James thing where it's like, oh, LeBron James isn't clutch, right? Cooper Flagg isn't clutch, which was interesting. I mean, that was one thing that they were talking pregame. It's like he's had troubles closing games. And again, it's a missed shot. It's not like a turnover like he's had earlier in the season when he was slipping, turning over the ball. This was just a missed shot, and he got a decent look. They were talking postgame how you would like to at least attack the rim, make the ref force a call. And I kind of agree with that, especially in college, especially the way that game was called a little bit, with them being a little bit more on the whistle happy side, especially on that free throw attempt in which they called Flag for that over the back, in which that was a play on, just let them play.
Yeah, especially in the way they were calling the game. Yeah.
Especially since they were in the bonus, or I think in the double bonus at least, in which then that gave Houston, you know, hey, you made the free throws, right? You got a ball, don't lie. But it was also like, come on. I think that was the only nitpick in the terms of the ending of this game. I think this game deserved a game-winning shot potential to end it. But overall, stellar game, and that sets up the matchup tonight between the Florida Gators and the Houston Cougars. That's going to tip off here in around 30-ish minutes, I believe.
Yeah, 30 on the nose.
Yeah. So let's go around as we get close to the end of this segment, and let's pick who we're going with tonight. Ian, we're going to start with you.
Well, I picked Houston to win my March Madness brackets, all of my two March Madness brackets, so I'm sticking with Houston. I think I actually picked Houston over Florida, but it's not like that's some novel thing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, based on the way that I was hyping up Houston for the last few minutes, you can guess where I'm going here.
Florida?
No. But no, I also did pick Houston before the season, so I want to just stay with that and, you know, make myself look better if it happens.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Going to be in contrast in styles. I mean, Florida is one of the fastest teams in the country. Houston's one of the slowest. Both excel at rebounding, forcing turnovers, shooting the ball. Should be a fun matchup.
You know, it's weird. I have Houston winning one of my brackets. I have Florida winning one of the brackets. What can I say? I'm really good at it.
oh, boy.
I'm going to go with the Gators on this one just based off of the Walter Clayton Jr. proponent of it.
Fair.
Usually, I think in national championship games, you don't want to pick the team that has the best player, which is like, if that doesn't make sense, but it's like, if they're reliant on him in the way, you don't necessarily want to pick him, especially in the styles. You usually want to trust the slower team, because then they can dictate the pace, whereas Florida could potentially speed it up and it could be a wider margin, but I think you can trust Houston to get stops late. But can they stop Walter Clayton Jr.? We'll have to see. Either way, both these teams are very deserving. I would love to see Houston win it for the Big 12, because again, it's great for TCU, and you got to be selfish in those reasons. My dad was like, you can't pick Baylor in the first round. I was like, hey, it's the Big 12. I'm going to pick them for one round. Got to show some love. So good luck to our Big 12 opponent, our Big 12
Big 12
friend.
Brethren. That's the Kelvin Sampson
Brethren. Houston on the road tonight in San Antonio for the championship game tonight. It's going to be exciting. That'll do it for this March Madness outlook of tonight's championship game between Houston and Florida. You're listening to Riff Ram Review. We'll be right back with some more segments. We're going to talk about some MLB and some NBA after this short break. You're listening to Riff Ram Review right here on KTCU The Choice, your choice for college radio.
The College of Communication here at TCU offers the ever-growing and always in-demand major of sports broadcasting.
Many ask, what exactly is taught in the sports broadcasting major? This popular field of study caters to us students that want to learn the skills to produce live and remote sporting events for both radio and television.
We acquire the skills to put together sports programming at the professional level, and we then use this new expertise to produce games you can watch on ESPN Plus or listen to right here on KTCU.
In addition to the hands-on experience, we also develop analytical skills to discuss and understand the social and cultural roles that sports play in countries around the globe.
If you would like more information on a rewarding degree in sports broadcasting here at TCU, please visit ftdm.tcu.edu.
Welcome back to Riff Ram Review right here on 88.7 The Choice. I'm Jackson James, running alongside Luke Anderson, Ian Apician. If you're just now joining us, welcome. So far, we've discussed TCU sports, range from basketball, men's and women's, baseball. We talked about the college national championship tonight in men's basketball. But now we're transitioning into some professional basketball as the NBA season is coming to a close. Teams have five or so games left on the season. It is dragged on for some, and it's flew by for others. But the postseason is on its way, and so let's take a quick look at the standings. We can look at the Western Conference first. It is OKC followed by Houston. They have clinched so far their respective seeds, I believe, or at least punched their ticket into the postseason. Then it's followed by the Lakers, Nuggets, Clippers, and the Golden State Warriors. And then teams currently in the play-in, it would be the Timberwolves, Grizzlies, Kings, and Mavericks. And then as we move on to the Eastern Conference, it is the Cavs and Celtics on top. And then it's the Knicks, Pacers, Bucks, and Pistons in the playoffs. And then in the play-in, it is the Magic, Hawks, Bulls, and Heat. I feel like that's always the end of the Eastern Conference. Bulls, yes. Heat, and the Heat. Or Hawks, Bulls, and Heat, as I should say. But let's dive into this a little bit. Let's start. I want to start in the Eastern Conference because I think this is actually not the most competitive conference, but I think there could be some interesting round one matchups. To set the stage, it is either going to be Cleveland or Boston in that first seed. Whoever gets that first seed, the other team will get the second seed. But then after that, it's kind of a crapshoot in terms of the seedings. 3 through 8, obviously the play-in, anything can happen there. I really like this Orlando team, but they've been slacking this season. They currently have a record of 38-40. They had their guys healthy. Obviously, Paolo Banchero coming back from that pec injury earlier this season. He's back, but it seems like they should be winning more. So maybe they could be a potential sleeper for whoever is that second seed, either Cleveland or Boston. But there's a team I do want to talk about, and it is the Milwaukee Bucks. I think this team obviously has high hopes this season, but they're dealing with some injuries, especially in the case of Damian Lillard. He has some blood clot in his calf that's holding him out indefinitely. I think that definitely puts a little bit of a stop sign up for this Bucks team. Luke, obviously, they're hoping to get at least a postseason healthy with Giannis. He's been really out the last two postseasons, but Dame being out kind of lowers the ceiling for this team a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's the right way to put it. It certainly, lowers the ceiling. Now, I will kind of just stand by what we said earlier in that I don't think that there's really any chance that a team comes out of the East that's not one of the top three seeds right now, and that's the Cavaliers, Celtics, or Knicks. You've got a couple interesting teams like we're talking about the Bucks right now. I do think that if they can get Damian Lillard back, then it'll have to be enough of a defensive jump with him back in the lineup for them to really compete, because they just struggle every time it seems like, defensively at least, that he's on the floor. But Giannis certainly kind of blossomed without Damian Lillard, obviously. I mean, you saw that before he got there, when he was a little bit more of a lone wolf, and the alpha male on that team, the go-to scorer. But now it's going to be interesting to see if they even really get any time to kind of work together before they have to just jump straight into the postseason play, because they've got a very difficult matchup as it stands right now with that four-seeded Indiana Pacers, I believe. And then if it gets switched around a little bit, it could even be the Knicks or the Pistons, which those are all very, very good defensive teams. And I just don't think that this Bucks team is going to be dynamic enough offensively. They're a little too one-dimensional. And then they're just not going to have the floor defensively to stand with these other teams in the East.
Yeah, the reason why I bring them up, you might be like, they seem irrelevant. Well, I think they have the best player in the conference, and so that's one thing that's going for them. But I do think they have a favorable matchup in round one, even without Dame. If that is Indiana, it might be tougher if they are the 5 seed going on the road to play the 4 seed. But even if it's New York, I think New York might be one of the more overrated teams, especially because they have such a bad record against the top teams in the league. That's been kind of their downfall, or their pitfall, I should say, this season. So I like the Bucks, but then it's also, you got to either play Cleveland or Boston in round two. And I just think those teams are on a collision course for that Eastern Conference final. But that will be an interesting one to depict once we get there, because I think Cleveland's good, but it's like they're good. Right, they're not great. I think, in which Boston has that prestige. So we'll see how that goes into the future. But let's transition into the Western Conference. This one, a much more competitive one. But the team I do want to talk about, and unfortunately, it is going to be the Lakers. And now the Lakers have been getting all the national media attention. Right, they're currently the 3 seed. They could go as high as the 2 seed, but they also could go as low as the 8 seed. Obviously, that's worst case scenario. They just defeated the Oklahoma City Thunder the other night. I think it was last night. And they pummeled them. They absolutely destroyed them. Let's see if I can find the score. It was 126-99. So they beat them by 27 points. And that's a shocking one. Just because I don't necessarily trust this Lakers team, especially in the depth that they have at the center position, or at least in their bigs. Jackson Hayes has had a great resurgence this season, especially when, you know, Doncic has come over. He's obviously going to make the center play a lot better just because he's such a great playmaker and draws so much attention. But after that, you're really asking a lot of LeBron at that defensive position. He may play the 4. He could play the 3, but then you're also, who's going to, he'll probably play the 3 if you have Doncic, Reeves, and then Bron. And then that 4 seed could be Dorian Finney-Smith that we've seen at points, and then a Jackson Hayes, which is a solid starting 5. But when you look at this Western Conference, I don't know if you can necessarily trust that.
Yeah, they certainly don't have the top-level depth that some of the other clear contenders do. But I think that's why it's important that you noted at the beginning that they can fall down to 8 pretty easily. And that's what makes the Western Conference such a fun conference every year. Because as it stands right now, the seeds 3 through 8 are all only separated by 1.5 games. At most. So it's just crazy to kind of really see these teams, these really, really solid teams, kind of be in some lower seeding positions that are probably going to make it a little bit more difficult in their first round matchup. So to that point, I think the Lakers are going to absolutely have to avoid the play-in tournament. They have to secure at least the number 6 spot, because that's going to give the Lakers at least a week for you know, a lot of their banged up players to get healthy. I mean, LeBron's been nursing, you know, an injury for the last few weeks, and you know, they've been playing him, you know, pretty banged up, and you know, Luka's always banged up, Rui Hachimura's been banged up. It just gives those guys a little bit more of a time to heal. By the time that they're, you know, back home, you know, at their home arena, they should have everyone full strength for the postseason. So, yeah, that seems to be the goal right now, that they want to get to that 3rd seed so they can avoid the Thunder, because I don't think that there's any way that they beat the Thunder. I do think, like you said, that depth is going to play a role. I don't think it'll play as big of a role until we get to those later rounds. So if they are able to avoid a team like the Thunder for as long as they possibly can, I think that that's only going to be a very, very good thing for them. So a lot of healing to do, but they also got to secure a spot to not be in the play-in.
Yeah, I think the Lakers, they definitely, you know, want to avoid that play-in. I also think they want to avoid Denver. You know, the Lakers haven't had too much success, even with Anthony Davis guarding, you know, Nikola Jokic. So they obviously want to avoid that. I think that's the worst case scenario. Obviously, play-in's probably the worst, but then that's like the second worst case scenario.
That's true.
Because then you could feel confident about any other team they would play. The Clippers, Warriors, Timberwolves, Grizzlies, Rockets even. You would feel fairly confident on the Lakers' ability, especially with Doncic on the team now, for their ability to overcome those opponents. But yeah, obviously, then you want to avoid the second round matchup with OKC. They could somewhat muster up a game or two, but I think that would be a max six game series. But overall, I think it's OKC's year, or if they don't do it this year, holy moly, would that be especially a choke job, especially, you know, with the fall, you know, especially with the Lakers lacking depth at the big man, Nuggets kind of withering at the towards the end of the season. They had a lot of momentum in January. That seems to have gone away. Houston could be a sneaky team. Right, we're not necessarily talking about them too much. So it's going to be a very competitive, competitive end of these final five games, as a lot is actually on the line. It feels like for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, no, a ton on the line. It seems like the West is kind of wide open, other than OKC. If somebody can knock off OKC, then it seems to be pretty wide open. Houston, a little bit too young this year. Seems like next year might more be in their window for competing. But yeah, Lakers definitely want to avoid that second round matchup with the Thunder, and I agree. Don't want to face the Nuggets either. So gonna need to win a couple of these last few games.
Who knows? Maybe the Mavs can get in some mix, actually. I'm just kidding. I hate the Mavs. Anyways, that'll do it for this NBA segment right here on Riff Ram Review. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to end off with our thoughts on week one of the MLB season. Some of our teams doing well, some of them not so much. So that'll do it for this NBA segment. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back with more Riff Ram Review right here on KTC, the choice, your choice for college radio.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. FeedThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard. So you don't need to ditch the car and start rollerblading to work.
I look ridiculous.
You look ridiculous!
You don't need to start foraging wild berries.
I was skeptical, but these are actually pretty good.
You don't need to sell your organs on the black market.
Lie back. This is gonna hurt.
Yeah, that hurts.
You don't need to rent out your apartment to drifters.
I made a fire with the wood in your bedroom.
That's my dresser!
And your closet door.
You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell all your belongings and live in a commune.
These dungarees belong to all of us now, Tom.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Riff Ram Review here on 88.7 KTCU The Choice. I'm Luke Anderson, joined alongside by Ian Napetian and Jackson James. We just wrapped up talking a little bit about the NBA playoff picture, and now we're going to move into some kind of first week and a half takeaways from the beginning of the MLB season. So I'll kind of just open it up there. And just kind of leave it a little open-ended for us to kind of shoot it together. But so what are kind of your guys' takeaways from this first week?
Man, well, I'm glad it's a week and a half, not the first week, because Rafi Devers is having a heck of a last couple of days. My goodness. So what did he start off, like 15 strikeouts?
16
0 for 16 with how many freaking strikeouts was that? First of all, I thought it was a very fun, entertaining first week. We've seen, it's very early, and Luke, I know you're going to touch on something about this too, but it's so early, it's kind of hard to figure out how well to take this first week and a half of baseball, right? Are we going to see these teams for the rest of the season this way, or are things going to shake out differently as well? I'll start in the AL West at least and kind of just talk about things there. The Rangers pitching has been absolutely phenomenal. My goodness. And over the last couple of games, their series against the Cincinnati Reds, when Jack Leiter threw, I believe, six shutout innings or so, show, and then Nathan Eovaldi went a complete game shutout, just gave up a couple of hits. The Rangers pitching staff has been really, really fantastic. The only thing there that I guess maybe is surprising and that could be a bit of a concern is the lack of a hitting, right? It's like the Rangers are winning games, aside from that Eovaldi complete game, you know, just by a couple of runs. It feels like the Rangers might only have to score 3 runs a game to win a game here. So I've been impressed by the Rangers pitching, not so much by their hitting. And then also looking at the National League, I mean, the NL West looks ridiculous with the Giants, Dodgers, and Padres all with less than 2 losses. The Giants 8-1, Dodgers 9-2, Padres 8-2. Those teams won't play each other for quite a while. Like, it's weird how the season starts, where there's not a lot of divisional games for a lot of teams until the middle or until the back end or start of May. But the NL West is looking like the division to look out for, just with how talented some of these teams are as well. So I've been really impressed through the first week or so of the season. I'm just so happy baseball's back. But Luke, I know you wanted to talk about a very specific team on the NL side of things. So
I'm giddy that baseball is back. But before I hop into that little precursor that you just gave me there, but I do want to give some flowers to another NLS team that you noted, and the San Francisco Giants are slugging. They're hitting the ball, and I feel like this was a little bit more of an underrated team this year. They kind of came in with an over under win total around like 81, 82. Kind of the same, you know, the same expectations for the San Francisco Giants as there always are. You know, kind of a middling team that could maybe, you know, get hot late and, you know, maybe make a push for the postseason, but only for the wild card spot, and they're never really actually in it. They're kind of one of those teams that kind of hang around, but their hitting is really, really taking a step up this year. I think this lineup is just a little bit deeper with the addition of Willy Adames. Matt Chapman is still slugging it well. And I just think that their lineup is a whole lot deeper than people gave them credit for. And then the rotation looks phenomenal as well. Yeah. I mean, they went in, or sorry, not went into, they were actually at their home ballpark, but they faced a very good pitching staff in the Mariners and won that series. So I think that's a very impressive win for them. But kind of shifting gears toward the absolute opposite end of the spectrum, hate to show a little bit of my bias here, but for the 2021 World Series, I'm kind of enjoying this one right here. The Atlanta Braves are off to one of the worst starts that you could possibly imagine. I mean, they are in the bottom of every offensive category, and they're sitting at, I believe, 1-8 after just stinking it up for the first week and a half. And now you got to give them, you know, some credit, because they did play a very good Dodgers team who it seems like they've shown the way to win. There are a million different ways to win in baseball, yeah. And it seems like they've won in all million of those ways, yep, in the first like 10 games is kind of what I was getting at. Yep. And yeah, they really just are a juggernaut, and they were able to, you know, just battle with them even if they weren't able to get to, you know, quite win the series. So I just think that this Braves team being the 29th offense in Major League Baseball, not getting on base, not hitting with runners in scoring position, not pitching nearly as well. Although I will say that Spencer Schwellenbach is a dog. He's a very, very solid young pitcher that they have. And once they get Strider back, that should quell a lot of the pitching concerns. But yeah, no, I mean, they dropped a game to the Marlins, or a series, or yeah, just a game to the Marlins after scoring 10 runs. So you kind of thought that they were starting to get back all the momentum after they go out and they win 10-0. And then they come back the next day, and it's just right back to the same issues. So just something to kind of monitor. We're not really raising any red flags yet, I don't think, or even like, you know, some yellow flags, but we're starting to get there if these struggles on the offensive side of the ball continue for much longer.
Yeah, I think it's so early, but I think I already want to start hanging the banner for my Chicago Cubs. Not only do they currently sit atop the NL Central with a 7-5 record, not too flashy. Japan kind of screwed us over, but we're back as we lead the league currently with 107 hits through the first 10-ish games of the season. But this team, man, Kyle Tucker, it's working. That's all I'm going to say. He's He had a horrible spring. That was kind of concerning, not going to lie. But he had a great series against the A's. It felt like he homered in every single one of those games.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Ian.
No, you're welcome.
But no, I'm just calling my shots right now because they're currently in action with the Texas Rangers. They're up 2-0 already. I mean, we can both celebrate that. Calling out all the shots, all the fans, all of our KTCU members here. They got different fans so far. The Cubs have beat most of them. The Dodgers later this week. But no, I think the NL Central, it's not too surprising in terms of how it's actually opened up, I would say. But definitely the NL East with the shocker of the Braves, for sure. I mean, the Mets, they seemed like, you know, especially at home, that seemed electric. Hopefully they can keep that momentum going at least. But it'll be interesting to see how those top teams really, you know, keep their season going so far. I think it's going to be really at the end of April. That's when I'm going to get a clearer picture on where these teams stand at least.
Yeah, and I mean, just talking about it, right? I mean, we are, you know, for most teams about 10 games in, right? And you think back to that 2020 season, when 60-game season, imagine starting off your year 1-8 in a 60-game season, right? Yeah. And again, I mean, that's, you know, when people ask about, oh, the season needs to be significantly shorter, it's like, look, there's a reason why baseball's a long season. It needs to allow for ebbs and flows, you know? I mean, shoot, you know, the Braves going 1-8, yeah, you know, starting off the season 1-8 is never good. Even when you can end the season on a high note, still, you'll look back and say, man, we could have gotten a couple more wins there if we were sharper here or sharper in these little facets. But it's just very interesting to start the season like this, and you're like, okay, this is why we play a long season. You know, even when the teams are good, we've seen teams fall off as well. So, yeah, I just kind of wanted to mention that.
Yeah, I think it's very important that you mention that because, you know, it allows all of these players and all these statistics, all these wins and losses to regress to the mean and to what these teams are truly made of. So yeah, no, it everybody complains about how long the season is, but it needs to be that long so that these truly talented teams can regress to the mean or to the average of what they're typically going to do. So yeah, no, I don't think the Braves are really even sounding any alarms in their clubhouse. No. I mean, I just want to like harken back to, I'm thinking about last year as an Astros fan, we were 7-19, and then we ended up being 12-24. No team starting 12-24 had ever gone on to make the postseason, and we ended up making the postseason and played at a 105 win pace for the rest of the season. The Braves have an even better offense than the Astros did last year, at least on paper, and they have a better pitching staff when fully healthy, I believe, than the Astros did last year on paper. So not out of the realm of possibility at all. They need to start winning some games pretty soon, though. But I'm not raising any red flags at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be tough, especially in their division. I mean, they play the Phillies this week. That's going to be a tough one.
Yeah.
But then they go on the road to Tampa Bay, on the road to Toronto. Then they play Minnesota. So, I mean, they can hopefully get a couple, you know, series wins there to get closer to 500. And I think that's the goal right now. Hey, let's just win some ball games, get to 500. And then we're going to look back in June and be like, oh, remember when they started 1-8, even 1-9? Like, that was funny. And then they're at the top, or at least in that wild card mix in mid-June. So I think for them, they need to get it going quick, though, because obviously you don't want to, you know, take all of April and be like, oh, kind of wasted April. Because that's going to come and bite you when it gets closer in September. So it's going to be interesting to see how the Phillies and Mets kind of take advantage of the Braves' slow start, because it's really up for grabs at this point.
Yeah, it's important that, right, I think that's equally important to talk about is like, yeah, while teams can struggle early on, it's about the other teams making sure that they take advantage of getting these wins, stacking wins when these other ball clubs are struggling, you know. Again, it's a very long season, baseball is, but, you know, you can always look back and pick out several games that you lost in very different ways and say, okay, you know, we could have won a couple series here, you know, or things like that. So, yeah, no, I mean, this was a very brief little look into the first, you know, 10 to 12 days of what is going to be a very long, a very fun season that we will continue to cover throughout the rest of this semester. We've only got 5 weeks left, folks. Kind of crazy. Luke has already graduated in December. Me and Jackson only got about 5 more weeks here on campus, which feels a little crazy. But we're going to spend it right, and we're going to enjoy. So, folks, thank you so much for tuning in, whether you're driving home or listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. We once again appreciate your support. If you do want to stay up to date with us here at Rare Frame Review on socials, be sure to find and follow us on Instagram, YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts at Riff Ram Review, or you can tune in every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on 88.7 The Choice. So that'll do it for us here in the studio. For Jackson James and Luke Anderson, I'm Ian Apician. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will see you all next time.